For the final segment of this program, the three GI tenors, I mean investigators, commented on the colorectal papers addressing EGFR-directed therapy, and Dr. Maripal began by presenting one of his patients.
I take care of a man who's about 63 years old, who was diagnosed in the fall or late summer of 2003 with stage 2 rectal cancer based on clinical staging. And he underwent neoadjuvant therapy with a combination of external beam radiation therapy and infusional 5-fluorouracil. I had a resection which showed a T3N0 rectal cancer. So it was stage 2 after neoadjuvant therapy. And he received postoperative adjuvant therapy with 4 months of FOLFOX. He did very well until September of 2006, so 3 years later, when he developed pulmonary metastases. And he had 2 pulmonary metastases, 1 in each lung. So we planned a resection at that time with curative intent. And the idea was that he would have a staged resection, first one lung, then the other. And he had his first lung resection in September 2006. There were some postoperative complications. So the next resection was in April 2007. He then was treated in the so-called adjuvant setting after metastasectomy with additional FOLFOX and bevacizumab for 6 months. And that ended about December 2007. And then early on in 2008, he started to develop on CAT scan. And we typically, after resection of metastases, will get CAT scans every 3 months. And at his first CAT scan, there was a hint that maybe he was developing something in the lungs again. And it was followed. And by the summer of 2008, there was serious concern that this was recurrent lung metastases. So we offered him chemotherapy at that time. And because these had arisen, in essence, while on FOLFOX and bevacizumab, or shortly thereafter, we offered him irinotecan and cetuximab. He was on irinotecan cetuximab between August of 2008 and recently, January of 2009, at which time we confirmed that he had ongoing stable disease. And the clinical question for us at this point was whether to continue this therapy or not.
Now, along the way, has he gotten RAS testing?
He did. Before using cetuximab, we obtained RAS testing, and he had wild-type RAS.
So, Howard, as you think through this case, what would you be thinking in terms of this question of whether to continue therapy or not?
With stable disease after 4 months of irinotecan cetuximab. Is that the question?
About 5 months.
Yeah. Probably I would, depending on his tolerance. I mean, I think the general impression is that the longer you give people chemotherapy, it tends to prolong their outcome. And, you know, I think we're all kind of trying to grapple with the stop-and-go effects, but you know, he's somebody who's already fairly well down the line and probably will continue to progress if you stop therapy altogether.
Now, how is he doing in terms of side effects and particularly in terms of dermatologic toxicity?
So he's had a skin rash, but it has been mild to moderate. So it hasn't required any intervention beyond moisturizing topical agents. And so it hasn't really interfered with his lifestyle, although all things considered, he'd rather not have the skin rash.
Now, what about the issue of preemptive therapy to try to prevent dermatologic toxicity? Eric Mariola-Coutura, a dermatologist, I think he has even a paper here. He's doing randomized studies on interventions. I mean, there's some suggestion, I think, that maybe using therapy up front as a preventive may be useful. What do you think about that?
Well, there are indeed some data. There is also data that Edith Mitchell presented, a so-called STEP study, which was a randomized study of which patients were treated with panitumab plus irinotecan, and then there was a randomization between treatment of skin toxicity at the moment it occurs or preemptive treatment. And it seems that patients with preemptive treatment, they had slightly less skin toxicity. Sample size was very small in the study, and for me, that's not yet a strategy that we do. We look carefully at our patients. We have an intense collaboration with the patients, and as soon as they develop some skin toxicity, we start treatment often with as well a combined local treatment, skin moisturizers and so on, as in combination with oral tetracyclines and sometimes in combination also with antihistamines if the skin is a bit itchy. But that's what we usually do in our clinical practice, and that's based on large experience with a lot of patients and also intensive collaboration with the dermatologist, I think. But if more and more data come true, then we might do it in the future. I think the data like STEP and some other studies are from relatively small studies today.
What do you see in your practice, Neil, in terms of quality of life of people who are receiving EGFR antibodies mainly, I'm sure, cetuximab? In one of our recent audio programs, your colleague Len Saltz was talking about some of the social stigmatization that some of these people experience. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, certainly when you have a side effect like hair loss or skin rash, that is an indicator of your current health state. And for patients with metastatic colon cancer, the vast majority of whom are living a relatively normal lifestyle during a large portion of their life with metastatic disease, that could be a problem. And I think that's why there might be more reluctance for some patients and some physicians to use cetuximab early on in the course of treatment. Now, after you've failed your initial therapy and you're later on in the course of therapy, then your trade-offs become different and you're more accepting of certain side effects than you might have been earlier on in treatment. And perhaps at that point it becomes less significant. But there's no question having a severe skin rash is a consideration for patients.
I've had a few people with fairly significant skin rashes, one who I had to give a letter to because he was going to Hong Kong and he was literally pulled aside by the public health authorities because his rash was not only noticeable across the room, but you could pick it up in a hall full of people going through the immigration line on the video camera. But, you know, he's done really well. He's had like a CR twice and a liver resection, and you know, he's managed to cope with it. I have another patient who's an accountant who's worked the whole time through his first-line therapy with this CAPOX cetuximab trial we're doing. And he told me his family literally does, his kids don't know he has colon cancer. He didn't want to tell them. He just tells them he has a skin rash, you know. And it's, you know, relatively noticeable. So I think that it's a problem for patients, but, you know, I think that it can be coped with. I think we have treatment strategies. I think people could use makeup, you know, if it's really an issue for them. I mean, it is somewhat of a sign, and it's clearly can be viewed as stigmatization, but it's a lot less stigmatizing than total alopecia, and it waxes and wanes, and I think it's, you know, something that people can cope with relatively well.
Of course, Eric, these agents are being looked at, or certainly cetuximab is being looked at in the adjuvant setting. How do you think that's going to play out as people decide about taking therapy?
Well, it's of course an important factor, but the way they will cope it will depend on the benefit, the amount of benefit, and that we don't know. We have actually running the PETAC-8 trial, which is a trial in stage 3 colon cancer patients, randomizing patients between FOLFOX or FOLFOX cetuximab. The protocol has been amended, also like the US protocol, to focus that in the KRAS wild-type patients. But usually patients cope okay, it's okay for them, because they know that the goal of an adjuvant treatment is to try to increase the cure rate, and because their treatment duration is fixed, it's 6 months and then they stop. So if that's the price the patient have to pay for it, at least to my experience, if we communicate very well for the patients, that's something that they will buy. And depends, of course, on the magnitude of the benefit. You need to show that there is an extra benefit and an extra cure rate or lower relapse rate in these patients. But if that's going to be the case, then I think we can cope with it.
I just wanted to add that I think now that we are taking out the group of people that don't respond and probably have less skin rash and are the ones who have, you know, when we see those curves where the skin rash intensity correlates with survival, I think they're the ones who do the worst and have the least rash, you know, becomes more of an issue for the people who are left, but they're the ones who are also going to benefit more. So it, I think, gives me a better feeling about prescribing the drug in people when I know they're wild type, because I know that their chance of benefiting is much higher. I'm not giving them toxicity for, you know, a 20% chance of benefit. It's probably double that now.
Eric, one of the papers we asked you to take a look at was just published in the JCO, commenting specifically on the issue of KRAS mutations and sensitivity EGFR inhibitors. Of course, this also relates back to your plenary presentation at the ASCO 2008 meeting from the CRYSTAL study and Dr. Eckert's discussion after that. And I mean, I think at this point, most oncologists are familiar with the basic data and what's going on. But I want to get your take on, you know, sort of what the next questions are that are out there that are being asked.
We had many relatively small retrospective studies showing the importance of KRAS as a marker for resistance. That's the best statement that we can make, that KRAS mutant patients, that they will not benefit probably from anti-EGFR targeted agents. So we had these different studies, third line. Then we had also the larger randomized data sets from the NCI study, also published now recently in the New England Journal of Medicine by Chris Karapetis and others. And then also the biology and the data came through also in the first line, the CRYSTAL study, OPUS study, all different studies, they are quite consistent in this setting. And so it's very logic. And the European authorities have even taken up this much faster. They have approved cetuximab in earlier lines, but limited in different lines to the KRAS wild-type population very fast because the data are so consistent. The challenge for the future, but we can talk later on that, is how we can further build up on other markers. Recently, there was a publication in the GCO on the predictive role of BRAF mutations. Around 10% of patients with colorectal cancer have a BRAF mutation, and they will not respond neither to cetuximab. It was a relatively small series in the GCO published by the Italian group. We have also now some of our data that are impressing more than 200 patients, so an even larger series confirming completely this BRAF story, and I'm sure other groups are also looking into that.
What percent of patients with colorectal cancer have BRAF mutations?
Around 10% of patients. So we have 40% KRAS mutants, 10% BRAF mutants, and these 50% of patients, they will not respond to cetuximab. So the puzzle is far from complete, but if you look at the pie chart, it's becoming a bit more complete, let's say it like that.
What did you think about this paper that just came out?
The paper in the GCR, I think, is a very nice paper from Gail Eckert and her group. What, in fact, is a bit of a discussion that she did at ASCO at the plenary session, highlighting the importance of KRAS as a predictive marker for resistance, and then also discussing some of the methodological issues. But, for instance, one of the important aspects is that the KRAS, you can do it as well on the primary tumor as on the metastasis, because KRAS mutation is an early event. And the several series that they've been looking in paired samples, primary tumor and metastasis, they found a similar rate of mutations. You don't need fresh tumor. You can do it on paraffin-embedded tumor. So you can go back if a patient was operated, for instance, 4 years before for colorectal cancer. You can just do the KRAS testing on this paraffin-embedded primary tumor. And some of these different aspects, as well as some of the aspects to understand better the biology of KRAS, are very well discussed in this paper in the GCO.
Howard, what about the issue of quality control in this assay? In breast cancer, there's all kinds of questions, HER2, ER, not getting it right, etc. I kind of been hearing that KRAS is a little more straightforward. Is that the case?
Well, this particular assay for mutations, activating mutations in the KRAS gene, is based on a fairly reproducible, much more reproducible assay. It's a RT-PCR of six different point mutations in codons 12 and 13. So, you know, with the primers and with the DNA, most labs will get the same results. I mean, I don't know that the experiment's actually been done, but the basic technology is much less subjective and much more reproducible than some of the HER2 testing. It's not like immunohistochemistry. So my feeling is that this will be pretty reproducible between lab to lab.
So, Neil, we asked you to talk about a paper that was published in December in the Annals of Oncology looking at epidermal growth factor gene copy number, KRAS mutation, in response to cetuximab 5-FU and radiation therapy in rectal cancer.
The underlying hypothesis here is that, a la what was found with Herceptin and the HER2 amplification story, perhaps with this other growth factor receptor, EGFR, a similar finding would be found insofar as those tumors that actually have amplification of the gene, more copies of the gene, would be more likely to respond to an inhibitor against the EGFR. And this was a relatively small study of 40 patients, and it was an analysis of a previously reported clinical data set where patients with rectal cancer were given neoadjuvant therapy with the standard course of radiation and infusional 5-FU, along with weekly cetuximab. And what they looked at in this laboratory analysis was whether RAS mutation and gene copy number were related in some way to the response rate in the tumor. And the response rate was categorized based on the percent of tumor cells that had died in the resected specimen. So it was the pathologist grading of the response. And what was found was, first of all, as expected, those tumors that had RAS mutations were less likely to have a robust response. The complete response rate overall was pretty small. So we're talking about, you know, a good response as measured by a pathology grading system. And interestingly, those patients who had an increased gene copy number were also more likely to respond with a good pathologic response than those who did not have an increased gene copy number. And this report is consistent with several other small studies that have suggested increased gene copy numbers associated with sensitivity to cetuximab or panitumumab. The hooker here is that these are small studies, and there have also been studies that have not confirmed these results. And one of the criticisms of the gene copy number story, if you will, is that different labs use different cutoffs for how they measure this and how they define this, and there hasn't been the same sort of consistency and reproducibility that has allowed cross-study comparison. So this is a worthy hypothesis that's now out there that should be confirmed or denied in a larger data set using a measure of gene copy number amplification that everyone around the table agrees to.
So what are your thoughts, Eric, in terms of gene copy number moving forward, what we know now? And also you were alluding to other markers to look at.
Yeah, I agree with what Neil said on the gene copy number. We, from our group, published also a series recently in Clinical Cancer Research a couple months ago, reporting the experience in over 100 patients. And the same findings were found that it might be a predictive factor. But I completely agree that we cannot apply that in clinical practice because of some of methodological issues, different cutoffs in different trials. So optimally, or in an ideal situation, we should do much larger trials. And before doing that, having consensus on what's the optimal cutoff and methodology. So it's for sure not so clear than the KRAS story, which is much more consistent and much more clearer. If you then look further and go into other markers, I mentioned already the BRAF story that is coming up now. BRAF, which seems to be also a very good predictive marker for resistance, at least if patients are BRAF mutant. And then other markers are being looked at. There are now, from at least three different groups, data presented in small series on the potential role of the ligands, amphianipurigalin, potential predictive role, telling us that patients with the KRAS wild type with high amphianipurigalin expression, that they might even more benefit than patients with the KRAS wild type status with low ligands.
So can you explain more what that means in terms of when you say ligands, ligands to what?
Well, the ligands, when cetuximab binds to the receptor, the ligands play a role in the setting on top of the receptor.
What are the ligands?
Amphianipurigalin are two of the ligands that are being measured in this setting, and that's not so clear today whether we will implement that in clinical practice, the measurement of these ligands on the tumor. But they might play an additional role on KRAS.
Are there any strategies out there, Howard, right now, looking at an attempt to decrease the ligands or other ways to attack the EGFR pathway?
Well, I mean, I guess the story with the two ligands is that, you know, if you have more stimulus and then you block it, those people may have more benefit. So there aren't any amphiregulin or epiregulin trap molecules out there or antibodies to the ligands, as we see with VEGF. So I don't think that that's a strategy now. I mean, we can block EGF at the binding domain. We can block it at the tyrosine kinase signaling domain. Then also we can prevent dimerization with drugs such as pertuzumab, which is, you know, an antibody that prevents homo and hetero dimerization of HER1 and HER2, you know, EGFR and HER2 both. So we've already got three different molecular mechanisms for interfering with this pathway.
And Neil, to what extent have we actually seen EGFR TKIs evaluated in colon cancer? I mean, I guess the impression is they don't work. Have they been studied adequately, and why don't they work?
I think they've been studied adequately, and there have been several studies with erlotinib as well as gefitinib indicating a lack of benefit in colorectal cancer. And I think this has to do with the pathogenesis vis-a-vis the EGFR pathway that is different in colon cancers than in lung cancers, for example. So the frequency of mutations in the EGFR tyrosine kinase domain in colon cancer is extremely small. And those tumors, colon cancers, don't respond to the inhibitors that attack that domain. On the other hand, in lung cancer, the frequency of these mutations in the domain is higher. And that's why the small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors that attach themselves to that area are effective. You know, what we've been talking about here is the biology of what happens in a colon cancer. There's a subset of colon cancers, those with RAS mutations, where RAS is always turned on, and therefore the signaling that takes place right at the inside of the cell where the EGFR attaches is always turned on. And so attacking something upstream with an antibody, you know, outside the cell, blocking the stimulation from the receptor is irrelevant in those patients because that receptor is always turned on because of the mutant RAS, regardless of what you do to tweak the receptor on top of mutant RAS. On the other hand, there are some colon cancers that aren't automatically turned on by mutant RAS. They're turned on by vigorous stimulation by their ligands, epiregulin and amphiregulin, for example. And that's why there's the data reported that increased in these ligands to stimulate the receptor is associated with a response to the antibodies that actually affect that part of the system, the binding of the ligand to the receptor. So we have pretty good biological explanations now of why the antibodies work in some patients in colon cancer, why they don't work in some patients with colon cancer, and why colon cancer and lung cancer are different. But as you've indicated, there's a long way to go because even among the patients who don't have a reason not to respond, most of them still don't respond.
Any hypotheses, Eric, about why that is?
No, that's probably many different hypotheses and different reasons why some patients don't respond. If you look just at 60% of patients with the KRAS wild type, there are, as I mentioned already, the 10% extra of BRAF mutations. We also know that the KRAS and a BRAF mutation is mutually exclusive, so either a patient can have a KRAS mutation, either a BRAF mutation, so they're mutually exclusive. But then there are probably other factors. If you just go downstream of the EGFR receptor, of the RAS-RAF MAP kinase pathway, and then there is, on the other side, there is the PI3 kinase, where also P10 interferes. That's not so well unraveled. And so this might also play a role that some of these markers, when there are changes in these markers, that this may play a role in resistance or sensitivity. But that's not yet clear. So that's a field of intensive ongoing research to unravel more, let's say, the 60% of patients or 50% of patients with KRAS and BRAF wild type, why some of these respond, but some of these are still resistant. So that's not yet clear.
What we've learned so far is almost in retrospect like low-hanging fruit. We've done the easy stuff. It's taken years, but in retrospect, it makes perfect sense from what we know about these pathways and how these drugs work. The difficult thing now is that in these pathways that Eric described, the RAS pathway, the AKT pathway, there are hundreds of proteins that interact with these pathways. And it is that complex interaction that is going to be difficult to ferret out and figure out which among those hundreds of proteins are the targets that will cooperate in shutting off a colon cancer cell. So we've really got the hard work ahead of us at this point.
Yeah, and then there are also other exciting and unsolved problems that, for instance, a patient with a KRAS wild-type tumor might have a spectacular response. What happens at the moment, after a couple of months, some of these patients have changes in their profile, their characteristics, so that they become suddenly resistant. What happens? That's completely unclear, neither. And in some patients, this occurs. They have a spectacular response for a couple of months, and then they become progressive. Some patients have a much more longer-lasting response. So that's these changes, and why a tumor that initially is sensitive becomes resistant, that's another story that we have to unravel and to make clear.
So, Howard, I know it was kind of a strange request to ask you to review this paper from the Clinical Experimental Dermatology, but I was curious because I'd heard about the issue of long eyelashes or trichomegaly from the lung cancer people, actually, with the EGFR TKIs. And then I see this paper here, the same thing with cetuximab. What do you think about it?
Well, you know, the side effect of trichomegaly or long eyelashes has been seen with other biologics as well. We described some cases with using recombinant interferon back in the day when that was a new drug, and we tried using it in solid tumors. And this has also been described for the anti-EGFR antibodies, where patients will develop much longer eyelashes, and it can be a clinical problem because it interferes with their vision. The eyelashes can become ingrown, and it can be problematic. So my NP has gotten pretty good at trimming eyelashes, and she does it on request. So that's how we handle it. In this particular paper, it was just a case report, but they did note that it was in a male who had been getting arena TKI with cetuximab, and he also developed, you know, the typical partial alopecia that we see occasionally with arena TKI. And so it didn't protect against alopecia on your head. It's pretty much just a stimulation of the hair follicles that produce eyelashes.
So, but when you say that, I mean, what's the mechanism?
It's differential stimulation, but I don't think that we really know, you know, why some cells develop, you know, to become eyelash, you know, producing cells, and some, the cells on the top of the head that not all of us have functional.
We don't know, and we have published that a couple of years ago already in the Annals of Oncology.
You published everything, no matter anything you've...
That's unbelievable.
That's a true
military. It's true,
it is true.
What
it
is seen is also with cetuximab that you see in some patients, some female patients, some of these,
yes.
How do you call that in English?
The
vellus hairs, the white, very soft hairs on their cheeks. You also see that it occurs. So there is for sure some effect on hair growth, but the mechanism has to be unraveled.
Fascinating. No, I mean, it's an all admiration to the amazing number of publications you guys put out there.
I just wanted to kind of reiterate something about the KRAS testing, and that is that the data for this has really captured the consensus of the people who work in this area because it's a pretty clear story, unlike many of the other biomarker stories that we've seen. And it's for a couple of reasons. Number one, the biology is completely consistent with everything that's come before it and what we understand about the pathway. Number two, the test is very reproducible. Number three, the test is done on very accessible specimens that we can do it in paraffin-embedded, formalin-fixed tissue that exists in colon cancer for most patients. And so in the studies, even though they were retrospective studies, they managed, for example, in the panitumumab study to have 85% of the people who were enrolled to have their specimens analyzed. So even in the retrospective studies, they had a high rate of being able to analyze these data. And finally, the data are very black and white. When you have a mutation in your KRAS gene that is activating the KRAS pathway, basically use of an EGFR antibody is useless. And that's been shown in multiple retrospective trials now, or multiple prospective trials that were analyzed retrospectively. So we're all pretty much on board with it. The FDA still is not so happy because these molecular analyses were done retrospectively. But I think as a community of oncologists, it's important to emphasize that the data from our point of view is very clear, and people who have these mutations should really not receive the drugs.